Let me make a, this is on the bottom of page 2, one other distinction. This is part of our menu of core concepts for our discussions of ideology. This is a distinction I've made, we also made around the political, the distinction between talking about ideology as a type of practice or as a dimension of practice. So when we talk about ideology as a type of practice, what we mean is that the purpose of a particular human activity can be to produce beliefs in other people. The purpose of a speech, when Obama gives a speech, the purpose of the speech is to affect the beliefs of the people who are listening to the speech. That is the goal of it, the intention of it. So what he is doing when he does that is he is doing an ideological practice. It's not just a byproduct of something else he's doing. It's the purpose of what he's doing. So when you talk about an ideological practice, what you mean is you're engaged in an activity which has as its purpose the production of a set of beliefs. We can also ever talk about the ideological aspects of practice, of an economic practice. So when a foreman walks through a factory observing workers and yells at some worker to get back to work and start working harder, the purpose of the foreman is to increase the rate of exploitation or to improve the efficiency or work effort of the workers. The purpose of that foreman is an economic practice. The foreman is engaging in the practice of mobilizing a particular kind of input into production to transform nature into the output by seeing that worker effort is being done. Those activities of the foreman have political aspects because it helps to reproduce the social relations of domination within the production process. But it also has ideological aspects. It reinforces beliefs about the way factories are run, about the appropriate roles for workers and bosses, about the natural order of authority within a workplace, and so on. So the foreman isn't going around and reminding workers, hey, remember, this is legitimate authority. He's not doing ideology most of the time. Sometimes, however, a worker is sloughing and the foreman will come along and give a little speech. Right? The worker will be reprimanded and will be told, don't you realize that if you slough off like this, the firm's going to go bankrupt and you're going to lose a job, then this is a capitalist firm and I'm your boss. You know, you'll get a whole discursive content where beliefs will be spoken, which will directly be listened to by, or not, by the worker in question. When the foreman does that, the foreman is doing ideology. When the foreman just goes about ordinary business, giving instructions, telling people to work harder, the foreman is engaged in economic and perhaps political practices with ideological byproducts. So just as, this is just this general point about the use of terms. You can talk about the ideological aspect of a practice or an ideological practice. The key indicator that something is an ideological practice is that, is by looking at the content of what's being done. When beliefs are being expressed and communicated, then the practice is an ideological practice in this sense. The purpose of the practice is to convey beliefs and to shape the beliefs of others. Okay, I think we can begin Terborne's analysis. Terborne's analysis of ideology falls squarely within the general conceptual space that I've mapped out here. His work takes off from the French philosopher Louis Althusser, who was a very prominent Marxist philosopher, particularly in the 1960s and early 70s. He then went crazy. He murdered his wife in a psychotic, at least the claim is that he was in a psychotic state and was spent the rest of his life in a mental hospital. There was a point in the late 70s that Althusser was the lead philosopher in France of a certain period of renaissance of Marxist thinking, and was referred to as a structuralist philosopher. That was sort of the rubric under which he was described. His most famous student or follower who was more empirical in his orientation was Nikos Poulantzas, a Greek expatriate living in Paris who worked on class and the state. So there was this period of a couple of years in which Althusser murdered his wife and Poulantzas committed suicide. And at the time, the work I was doing was in this tradition, although I think clearer than Althusser and Poulantzas, but it was informed by their structuralist approach to Marxist work. And I co-taught a course with my friend Andy Levine. We wrote a lot together at the time. He was in the philosophy department here at the time. And at one point in a class when we were talking, this was which we were teaching together, shortly after Poulantzas committed suicide, Andy turned to me and said, "Okay, Althusser kills his wife, Poulantzas kills himself, what are you going to do?" I'm looking at myself. I don't think you have to worry that structuralist ideas somehow provoke people to such despair about the world that their only reaction is violent thrashing out at others or themselves. Terborn takes off from Althusser's work, and in The Power of Ideology and the Ideology of Power, there are residues of Althusserian language in it, which make it harder than it would otherwise be. In particular, Althusser has this term, interpolation, as a way of talking about what ideology does. What ideology does, according to Althusser, is interpolates social subjects. Well, interpolate is a terrible English word. I don't even know if it is a word in English, really.
In Spanish, it's a word.
It's a word. But it doesn't communicate anything in English. It doesn't, if I said, well, just as somebody off the street, even an educated person, tell me, what do you think interpolating a subject means? They wouldn't have a clue what I was.
Isn't that redundant? Like interpolating includes, you can't, like interpolating a subject is sort of, that is the process of interpolation.
No, I don't know. You can interpolation. So
totally
the French.
Know what I said,
so here's Althusser's construction of this obscure concept in English. There's the French word appel, which means to hail, to call someone. Appeler, call. He likes the English translation of appel in the Althusserian corpus is hail. You're hailing a cab. You're calling a cab. You raise your hand. So interpolation means hailing a subject, saying, "Hi, hey, you. You're the subject," and telling them where they fit within social relations. To me, that's a really obscure way of talking about the formation of the social subject as a capable, competent actor within relations. But that's basically what Althusser is trying to talk about. Althusser uses the term interpolation, which means hailing people as subjects. Terborn also adopts that word, but he doesn't actually use it that much, and his elaboration is much clearer than anything Althusser ever wrote. If you find Terborn's work interesting and you want to read the sources, the kind of inspiration to get more background on it, you can read Althusser's book on ideology, but it's really tough sledding. Partially, this is because of a certain French tradition in high-level academic writing, in which I think clarity is not an important value. I mean this seriously. I think there is a certain cachet in being difficult in French writing, and that it's seen as more serious if people have to struggle over it than if they can figure it out easily. And so people don't worry about whether what they're writing is really difficult. One of the consequences is that for lots of French philosophers, in the discussions of it, people are debating what they really meant, rather than whether the ideas are useful or enlightening or helpful in solving problems. And to me, it's always a bad sign when the main debates about a body of work are what they were really trying to say, that it's a failure on the part of the original writing. On the other hand, I've been attacked for being too clear. There was one, Paul Piccone, I don't know if he's still, his name has ever comes up in any longer. He was a writer for Telos in the 1970s and 80s, and he attacked me for being too clear. He said that clarity is a form of domination because it's a way of imposing your ideas on others unless they are as capable as you are of defending themselves. So since I'm an educated theorist and have honed my skills by being so clear, I don't give you the autonomy.
And formulate that critique.
Formulate your ideas for you.
Well, no.
I should have the freedom.
Yeah, so whereas I've always felt that the advantage of clarity is it helps people figure out why they disagree. Anyway, I don't have to belabor those points. So Terborn has really a quite grand project in this short book. In terms of, to me it's a terrific virtue of The Power of Ideology and the Ideology of Power that it's such a compact, efficient statement of these ideas. You don't have to wade through 300 pages of commentary on everybody else in order to get to the core of his ideas. It's an efficient book for laying out a research program, a theoretical program. He has a very ambitious project here. He wants to create a set of concepts which makes possible the historical investigation of ideology. That means he wants to move from the level of abstraction of most of what Althusser wrote about, which was ideology in general, to the level of studying the variability of ideology and how it works in different times and places. So he wants to provide us with a set of concepts that enables us to really understand and use these concepts for studying historical context, variation, and transformation. He wants to develop a concept of ideology that is fully capable of understanding non-class aspects of subjectivity and the formation of a social subject, not just class aspects of subjectivity. He sees people as being multiple subjects, and we are interpolated, that is, we're formed as social beings, as social subjects, in many ways, not just one. So that at a minimum, we are all gendered subjects, as well as classed subjects, as well as ethnic or racial or geographically specified cultural subjects. So we have these multiple subjectivities. And in each case, we have to ask, how are those subjectivities formed? How are the beliefs we have that enable us to function in these different roles as social beings formed? He wants also to give a account of the mechanisms for different types of and the different dimensions of the formation of our subjectivity, even within any one of these general types. So when you think about gender, what it means to be formed as a gendered subject, this is itself a very complicated matter. There are many different dimensions to gendering of subjectivity. He wants to develop a space of concepts that enable us to treat this not just as some kind of homogeneous, unified process, where people are formed as a unitary gendered subject, but as a multidimensional process with lots of potentials for tensions and contradictions. And that, I think, is his ultimate purpose, is to understand the formation of subjectivity and of the social subject as a contradictory process, rather than as a static one. He wants to get away from a kind of equilibrium analysis, where everything fits together nicely in a kind of static whole. He wants to have contradiction, the notion of contradiction, being more than merely some disturbance, sort of noise in the system, and provide a way for us to have a systematic understanding of the contradictions of subjectivity. In this respect, I think his goals go beyond anything I've seen in Bourdieu, for example. I think there's a lot of intersection and overlap between Terborn's views and Bourdieu's. But Bourdieu, at least as I read it, does not have at the center of his analysis understanding the systematic ways in which people don't fit into the social relations in which they live. Bourdieu is, in a sense, is a theory of equilibrium, whereas Terborn wants to develop a theory that equally enables us to understand disequilibrium, the ways in which we're formed as social subjects in ways that are ill-fitted to the roles which we are destined for, and thus that there can be contradictions that are systematic rather than just noise in the system. We won't have time, I mean, not only today, but this will, my analysis of exposition of Terborn will spill over until the next lecture, obviously. But we're not going to have time to go through all of his work. There's some very interesting things which I won't be able to discuss explicitly in the lectures. I think his notion of ego, what he calls ego and alter ideologies, are also extremely interesting and fruitful. I'll mention these when we get to that part, but I'm not going to really be able to delve systematically into all of those aspects of his work. What I'm going to try to do is to really get at the core mechanisms which he sees as driving this process, and which then set up this possibility of understanding ideology and its effects on the human subject as contradictory rather than unitary. Let me just end with his definition of ideology, which you'll see that how it bears on my discussion of ideological practice, which I think has some really elegant features to his definition. So here's how he defines ideology. This is on page 4 of my notes. The operation of ideology in human life involves fundamentally constituting and patterning how human beings live their lives, and then this is the key part, as conscious, reflecting initiators of act in a universe of meaning. Conscious, reflecting initiators of acts in a universe of meaning. In this sense, ideology constitutes human beings as subjects. Now that expression, conscious, reflecting initiators of acts, that's Terborn's conception of the human agent, what it means to be a human being acting in a social setting. We're not simply enactors of roles, we are conscious, reflecting initiators of acts. Initiators of acts. We make choices, we do so creatively, we initiate action in a way that's conscious, we have intentions, and reflective. We know we have intentions. We think about how we think about what we're going to do. People are constantly reflecting on their own beliefs in action as they initiate action. Now that's a rich understanding of human agency, much richer than the view that we are simply playing out roles that we are taught, that we're simply socialized creatures of habit. We are conscious, reflecting initiators of acts. And he wants to interrogate the process by which we are capable of doing that. And his account of ideology and the formation of beliefs provides at least a framework for approaching that kind of question. What I will do then on Wednesdays, begin on page 5 of the notes for today.